You're listening to KBOO. I'm Eric Jorgen Jorgensen for Between the Covers, and I am speaking today with writer Amy Bender. Amy Bender is the author of The Girl in the Flammable Skirt, An Invisible Sign of My Own, Willful Creatures, and now her latest novel just came out. It is called The Particular Sadness of Lemon Cake. She is familiar, of course, to most of us here in Portland as a frequent and celebrated contributor to Tin House, our own local literary journal. She is also a teacher of creative writing at the University of Southern California. Amy Bender, welcome once again to Portland, and welcome to KBOO.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
So your newest book, and I don't think this is going to be a spoiler because I think this is on most of the reviews and information stuff that's out there, follows a young girl, Rose, from about 9 to her sort of young adulthood. And she, at the age of 9 or right before 9, discovers she has a very peculiar talent and gift. And can you tell us about what that is and how that sort of came to you as being something to focus a book around?
Sure. And well, what she discovers basically is she tastes a piece of cake that her mother has baked for her birthday. And she can taste all these feelings in it that she kind of senses are connected to her mother, feelings that aren't really being talked about. And they're kind of baked directly into the cake. And she is totally overwhelmed by this discovery. And it's kind of tracking her life, though the book, I was talking about this with someone earlier today. It's not just about that, because I think it feels like it's a book that's going to be mainly about that because of, I guess, that being the premise. But then it sort of ends up being a really book about a family.
And on that note, sort of being about the family, I thought something that was interesting is she's only 9 when she discovers this, right? Which is sort of an extremely young age to come to that terrifying realization that your parents are people and that, like, maybe your mother isn't completely satisfied with your life. So why did you do someone that young? Did you yourself feel like, as a very young person, you came to that kind of realization earlier than most people?
I think there was something that interested me about that. Yeah, the disconnect, I guess, between the adult world being kind of felt or perceived by the kid mind, or in some way, you know, so there's this clash, and that it would be totally overwhelming to her. And that felt really important because I think there is something about timing that is big. But I do think, I mean, I can't even trace a specific instance where I might have felt that, but I did feel aware of adults and aware of maybe the complexity of adults as a kid. But I kind of think most kids do, you know, the same way that yeah. people will feel like, you know, just kids are so perceptive and that it's inarticulable. I think for a kid in that moment, it's just sensation or it's just hunches. But I think kids in a room are really picking up on a lot.
Which is kind of echoed in how she experiences these feelings from her mother, because it's kind of a visceral thing more so than mind reading, I guess you could say.
Exactly. Like an experience of a feeling and just almost a hunch as opposed to any kind of concrete sense. And I think that's also part of what makes it overwhelming, is it really, she then has to experience those feelings for herself.
Right. What I thought was really interesting about the use of food for this sort of medium was that it's something that we don't, even though it's something we perceive because we taste it, it's something that we don't normally associate with an emotion in the same way that we do with like a piece of music or something. And one of the reasons I think that's sort of apt is because we don't, you know, when you write a piece of music, you write it with the intention of it being sad or happy or, you know, more complex feelings than that. But when when her mother is cooking, it's like her feelings are just sort of, you know, baked into the thing, as opposed to her trying to portray something with this dish. Mm-hmm. Do you as a person sort of have, what is your emotional connection to food? Do you think food has an emotional component outside of, like, you know, a situation that we remember having eaten that food in and therefore it makes us happy, but like it actually intrinsically in the food?
I mean, I think it's interesting what you say, because it feels like, like for a real chef, food is definitely art, and then art conveys a feeling as a Mozart sonata, you know, conveys a feeling as, you know, a poem. So it kind of makes sense too that you would get some experience or some feeling from like a beautifully made something. But I think we're all doing it. Like most people in some way are putting food together in some way or another. So there's a whole spectrum of that, like incredible Mozart sonata steak or whatever. And then, you know, the sandwich I'll make myself for lunch, which is, you know, right. I feel really proud if I put balsamic vinegar on it. You know, I feel triumphant. So I guess it's true that it is communicating something. I mean, I feel like generally I'll think of food as being I'll associate it with positive feelings, with some, you know, if someone makes me something, I feel so appreciative. I love being cooked for. I really like cooking, all of that. But it's in my own life, it's not, I don't usually have that experience of, you know, disliking it. Though as a kid, I was a very picky eater. So there may be an element of that too, where I remember that feeling of every food felt kind of inaccessible to me because I was a little kid and my taste buds were not developed and I really just liked peanut butter. That was kind of it.
That's interesting that you say inaccessible, because part of it is she can taste like all the different components of the food, right? And like where they came from. And she's got sort of this like, omniscient sort of knowledge of everything she eats, which is kind of, I mean, obviously it's not really a good thing, you know, because it can be very troubling and sort of so much information in your mind to keep track of. How does that play into, I mean, how are you someone that's very conscious about where your food is coming from or that kind of?
I mean, I think I've definitely been enjoying all the food movement stuff that's been happening. I think it's really fun to see how that affects restaurants and stores and farmers markets, and it has affected books, you know, the whole like Michael Pollan is a household name now and he wasn't. So I think all of that does interest me a lot. But I think what it felt important to me in the book was also that so that she's kind of aware, she has this kind of super access, like you're saying, which is totally overwhelming to her. But then also she finds refuge in foods that are made in factories and by machines.
Right.
And there is some piece of that I feel rings true to me in terms of like, yes, I want that beautifully made and beautifully cared for food, but maybe, you know, there definitely have been times in my life where it felt like the bag of Doritos was the ultimate comfort.
Yeah, well, what I really got from that whole thing, which I love, by the way, of her sort of clinging to processed food as an emotional comfort because of its lack of sort of a personal emotional connection, which is you know, sort of ripe with metaphor on a number of levels. But one thing I really liked about that particular idea was that it was sort of the familiarity of that, you know, like a processed food. You know, every time you get a Dorito, it's going to taste the same.
Always the same.
And so it's sort of, exactly.
It's kind of amazing and horrible.
Yeah, exactly. Or if you go to a chain restaurant, like, you know, all the lemons at every Chipotle are like cut exactly the same. And it's part of this, like, I saw it as this interesting commentary on like American obsession with security and sort of this idea that like we expect we expect to always be happy and have that same emotion, so we, you know, load ourselves up with, you know, psychotropic medications, and we, you know, always expect the future to hold exactly what we want it to, so we pile on all these insurance policies and stuff onto our lives, and we want our food to always taste the same. We've lost that sort of scary sense of feeling emotions that, you know, aren't pleasant or scary, and sort of just approaching that as in a kind of scary but organic way.
Yeah, and that there is some kind of safety that becomes very oppressive in that, and I think, but that people are drawn to, and that I can feel moments in my life of being drawn to that. Or I remember finding out that the California Pizza Kitchen serving staff are speaking on a script. So when they come to your table, there's a script for what they say when you sit down. And then once you've gotten your food and all of that, and it just, and it's the same thing, right? There's on some level that must be appealing to people because there is the familiarity, but there's something so awful about it, particularly for that, because that's about human connection, right? That's about, I like my waiter who's so lovely and kind and friendly, and then you realize like the waiter at the next table was saying the same words, and granted they may mean what they're saying, but it's it feels similar in some way to like the Doritoization of being at a restaurant.
I was just thinking about, I think I've experienced that before, being home in the Midwest, going to like the Olive Garden with my parents and getting the same sort of speech. And you're like, oh, well, you know, it's...
And it's hard on the wait staff, right?
Oh, of course it is.
I feel this like incredible sympathy of like, that's hard to say over and over. And what happens if they stray and, you know.
Yeah, and you lose like that entire. I mean, that's like almost an extreme example of being cut off from your food. Like,
right.
You're cut off from even like talking in an organic way to who's like bringing you your food, not even the person cooking it.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, I'm Eric Jorgen Jorgensen for Between the Covers here on KBOO. I'm speaking today with writer Amy Bender. Her newest novel, The Particular Sadness of Lemon Cake, is out now. Please stay tuned for more of my interview with writer Amy Bender. I know you probably get this a lot and you probably hate it, but I was, I thought that the book would make a wonderful film,
yeah.
As I think some of the short stories and Willful Creatures, I thought would also make great little, short, like animated things or something like that. Has anybody ever approached you about that or
for this one? Not yet. Cause I think it's just out and, I mean, I guess there's that dilemma of the food element, but, you know, like film can figure, you know,
right.
Like Ratatouille.
Right.
That was a great film about food. But it's also, and there's other stuff in it, of course, that is maybe in some ways more filmable. But about the short stories, yeah, there have been some options on stories that are just kind of floating in the atmosphere. And they did actually make a movie of my other novel, An Invisible Sign of My Own. But I don't know where the status is, mm-hmm. but it was filmed. So
very cool.
Yeah, but it's interesting, cause, and especially because I live in L.A., so there's something about being, like, I'm very happy if someone's interested in making something, but I like to keep it really separate so that it can kind of become its own thing. I love your idea of an animated, of a short story that would be very
an interpretation
satisfying.
And not something that's like trying to be.
Yeah. That I think that's, you know, that's why the movie adaptation was such a great adaptation.
Right.
It felt like he really let it happen as its own thing.
And it's true that I didn't think about that at the time, but there are the passages about food are so descriptive that, it would be difficult to get that same kind of like, and because the descriptions of the food are so tied up in like the emotions that they, you know, carry.
Exactly.
That would be hard to get on camera.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's like someone could figure it out, but I don't know how to do that.
Right.
It will not be me.
But I was going to ask that because, partially because you do live in LA and LA, you don't think of LA as being a writer's town, mm-hmm. really. And, this is sort of, I guess, the segue into just more about writing, but you grew up in Southern California, and you teach at USC, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, I always thought of that whole area as being only, you know, that's where all your like film and sitcom writers live. But, you know, of course you live there and, you know, David Foster Wallace lived down there and all this stuff. And so it's sort of gaining this, you know, this reputation. As
Jonathan Lethem is about to move to take David Foster Wallace's former job.
Yeah. No.
Yeah. So there's more.
Wait, Jonathan Lethem of The Fortress of Solitude. He's like the Brooklyn
I
writer.
I know. He's Mr. Brooklyn, but I think it's kind of great. Like he come to California.
I didn't know he was taking.
And he lived in Berkeley for a while. So.
Oh, he did.
But yeah. So.
Oh, that would make sense because at the end of that book, there's that whole bit about being in Berkeley. But
yeah. But yeah. Anyway, just to throw another name in the mix.
Right.
But yeah. Well, go ahead.
Just going to ask you what you felt about LA as a writing town, a literary town in general.
Yeah, I mean, what's nice is there are a lot of writers, and it's like a literary town under the radar, which I kind of love about it, in that everyone is writing screenplays, and they're at coffee shops. Everyone's got a laptop. There, you walk by the laptops, and they're all final draft, you know, or the software that you know is split into script form. So there's a great freedom, I think, I feel in saying that I write fiction, or I have some friends that are poets, and it feels like that's even more extreme to live in LA and say I'm a poet or playwright. You know, maybe that may be the most shocking of all.
Right.
But I think it's nice because there's something about, in my mind, that's I like about sort of going against the industry of the city, because it feels like there's just a lot of support.
Yeah.
And there's it just means you're kind of in this smaller group, but all the writers are incredibly nice to each other. You see people over and over again. But there's a fair amount of people. And I teach with T.C. Boyle and Percival Everett and Marion Wiggins and all these people whose work I really like. And so there's just a lot of kind of excitement in the under the radar quality, you know?
Right. Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah. So it's in the same way that, like, I feel like if I did ever move to New York, maybe I would start making films. You know, that would be nothing. I don't think I'll ever start making films. Maybe I'll live in New York. Who knows what will happen? But
how do you like teaching?
I like teaching a lot. I really do. And I used to teach elementary school, and then I taught when I was a grad student. And then when I got out of graduate school, I started teaching. So it's been almost 20 years. So it's been a long time. But I really love the balance of writing being so solitary and internal, and then going out into my day and interacting with people. And so I think, I have to teach because I need the job.
Right, right.
But even if I didn't, I think I would want to do it in some form or another.
Yeah, it's always interesting to hear sort of how people who were artists first and teachers, which I guess in your case is kind of different because you've been a teacher in so many different settings before.
Yeah.
But it's often interesting to hear a lot of people who were writers and then became teachers, how difficult teaching was to sort of get started, and how, you know, just because you feel like you know your craft so well, and you don't realize sometimes how much of it is actually intuitive and is mm-hmm. difficult to explain and to teach and try to help other mm-hmm. other students.
I don't think there's any natural correlation between the two. So it feels like if a person likes writing and teaching, that's a happy coincidence, because there isn't. Yeah, they're such different activities.
Right.
And I think I know a lot of people, too, will feel like if the students aren't writing at a high level, they can get really disappointed in that. But I guess what I like is that I am assuming most of the students I have are not going to publish, they're not going to keep pursuing their writing, but that the act of taking writing seriously and kind of getting your feet wet, getting into the creative process is such a good thing to experience. Mm-hmm. Like it can be applied to your life in a million ways. So I believe in that wholeheartedly. So then it doesn't really matter. Usually they'll improve to some degree, but it doesn't matter to me if then they're like, I am, you know, this is my career path. That feels beside the point.
Right. Do you feel that you gain a certain sense of inspiration from teaching, or do you think it's sort of inhibiting to have to, academicize, I guess, this art form?
Well, I mean, right, the academicize, just like, I like that word. Happily, I feel like I don't want to do that ever. Like, a lot of what I want to do is talk about fiction in the most kind of hands-on, you know, the muck of it as possible, and to start clearing away some of these weird assumptions and just crap that gets layered on people's ideas of fiction. And so that it's not my job to be studying it, or that we're not creating scholars, but for people to go in and be experimenting with writing. And then that's another way to learn how to read. So it's like they can be taking their class where they're learning how to analyze a novel. But then also if we're reading a novel and just talking about the writing process, then it's mm-hmm. different. It's connected, but it's different. So I guess it's felt on the whole, I think it's just felt like a nice thing to have those interactions.
Right.
And I like the students a lot, and they're just fun to talk to. And it just feels to me so different than the process of sitting down at the computer and sort of searching around and exploring and finding a story like that. So they just don't even feel related. We're talking about the same thing, but they almost feel like completely apples and oranges.
Right. How do you, it's just like a pragmatic question. How do you balance the two? Like, do you do your mm-hmm. writing, you know, like late into the night, or you know,
I'll write in the morning, and I have like a 2-hour morning schedule that I've been on for 15 years. So it's like, I'll sit down, I'll do my writing. I'm done usually by 10:30. And then, I usually don't teach till 2
mm-hmm.
or I'll have office hours at like 12:30. So then it's fine. Like I can go and then teach. And it's nice actually that whenever I've taught, I've already written for the day. So there's no feeling of like the student time is encroaching on my writing time, right, or the more like externally focused space is encroaching on the internal focus of the writing. It feels like the writing gets priority, but then it's done.
Right. So you don't get that. There's a David Foster Wallace quote about how I write for an hour a day and worry about not writing for the other eight or whatever. Yeah.
Right.
It's a good feeling to avoid. So that sort of answers my question, because you're a teacher, but I was actually going to ask you as a successful, contemporary writer of fiction, how authors make a living in sort of the contemporary world. I mean, there's, you know, there are very few people, who even get the readership that you have now, you know, and it's, you know, if you're not sort of the Danielle Steele of the day or whatever, and you're, and you're more into writing fiction that's I hesitate to say interesting, but you know what I mean.
Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, what does that look like? What does the future look like? How have you done it for so long? I mean, now obviously you teach, and like teaching is a great, I'm sure, a great gig for a writer to have.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, most writers I know are not supporting themselves through writing. I mean, I think it with students too, that will say like, I want to write a blockbuster. I feel like that's not the reason to go to fiction. Like, that's not reason to sign up for a fiction workshop just because you want to make money. It just does not seem to match. And also, I think it's helpful when you sit down to do the writing, or at least for me, it's been helpful to feel like I always knew that I would have another job, because I didn't want in any way any of the choices I made to be affected by my guesses about marketplace. Because first of all, I don't think you can anticipate marketplace, but I don't even want to think about that. I just don't want to think about that. So then teaching for me was a natural fit, but I think I would say most of the people that I know are doing some kind of teaching. Occasionally people will try for movie stuff, but that's its own difficult business. And sometimes someone will have a completely other job, or like I have a friend who writes poetry and she works at Mattel because she was able to, she worked in advertising and then she had this MFA and then together they kind of made, so she was like naming dolls and writing descriptions of dolls, which sounds great, and watching children play and then going home and writing her own poems. So I think that was a smart way to balance it too. But it's tough. It's tough too. I mean, I feel it. The lucky thing is I actually like the shorter amount of writing time. And if I was a writer that wanted 8 hours to kind of warm up to the work and spend the whole day, it would be a lot harder.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually find that difficult to have that much time.
Right. And having to, like, if you go about it, it would seem to me, with the intention of writing a blockbuster, I mean, what a tremendous amount of pressure. I mean, it would be
pressure, and I mean, then it's all about money. Like, like why do that ultimately with fiction? I mean, unless it's like you're someone who thinks in terms of big sort of schematic plot books, then maybe you can do it. But even, I don't know, even so.
Yeah, that seems tough.
Yeah, it seems tough and kind of depressing. It does.
No, it's like, does. Yeah. Well, it was, No, it was, Charles Ives, the great American composer, was an insurance executive by day, and you know, and he used to always say that even this, this was after he won the Pulitzer Prize and had money that he could have put in back into his composition career. But he always said that being an insurance salesman by day sort of freed him from having any financial obligations when it came to his work, so he could do whatever he wanted to do. And I'm sure you have, do you have a good relationship with your publisher or your editor that you work with?
They're great. I mean, they're great, and they've been super supportive all the way. And I have the same editor for all four books, which is rare these days because there's been a lot of shifting in houses and in publishing. So that's been great. But it just makes, Wallace Stevens, the poet, apparently also was, I think, vice president or maybe even president of an insurance company and would write his poems on his walk to work. You know, these like unbelievable, beautiful, deep poems. And then he'd go to his work. So sometimes it helps to have that structure to push against too. I mean, creatively, I think that can help.
Well, right. And, you know, not writing in a vacuum and all of that, I suppose.
But right. True.
Very cool. That's about all the time that we have, but this has been fantastic. Thanks for joining me.
Totally a pleasure to talk to.
Thanks for writing fantastic work, and I hope you enjoy your stay in Portland.
Thank you. Thank you.
Amy Bender, thanks for joining us. You've been listening to Between the Covers on KBOO. I'm Eric Jorgen Jorgensen, and you just heard my interview with writer Amy Bender. Her new book, The Particular Sadness of Lemon Cake, is out now. You can learn more about Amy Bender as well as her books at her website, which is flammableskirt.com. Again, that's flammableskirt.com. Once again, I'm Eric Jorgen Jorgensen. This has been Between the Covers. Thanks for listening.